Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Above the Bar podcast, a show about a middle-aged father, current events, and how these things affect my everyday life. Welcome to another episode of the Above the Bar podcast. With us today, we have Chris McDaniel. He is currently a performer out in Branson, Missouri. I won't say how many years he's been performing. I'll let him do that. All I know is as far back as I could find was 1972. And currently he does Wild West Arts. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean. It's nice to be with you.
So you're out in Branson right now, right?
Yes, I am. It's one of the only places that I know of in the country that's that has actual theater performances. So that's where I am now.
Well, do you have all the snow out there yet? I saw on the news that like Minnesota had like already getting like hammered with snow.
No, we're not, thankfully. We've gotten some fog and some rain, and it's starting to get colder, but right now it's going back and forth between the 80s during the day and some days it's the high 60. So we're starting to get there.
Oh, I understand. That's the way we are here in upstate. So now I joked around. I said the furthest back I could find was for you was 1972. When did you actually get into entertaining it as a general thing, like performing?
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, my father was a Southern Baptist preacher, and I'm feeling much better now. But no, he was a Southern Baptist preacher, and I preached my first sermon, if you could call it that, when I was six. Now, my family didn't pimp me out. I was never put out there to preach or anything. I just wanted to be like my dad. I later on started singing in church. And singing in school and acting in school. So I guess you could say I've been entertaining pretty much my whole life as far as that goes. As far as general, my degree in college is vocal performance, which qualifies you to do pretty much nothing but sing. And I have a minor in theater. And yeah, so that's where I started out. Was doing that and doing a lot of gospel music and mostly that when I was younger.
Now you said you have your degrees in theater. Did you ever do any TV performances, any stuff like that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've done quite a bit over the years. I took a long time to finish college because I was, I would take a year off here and traveled with a group that performed at high schools. We made almost nothing, but it was like boot camp for performance. Took a year out of college to do that. Bounced in and out of college. Took me about 9 years to finally get my degree because I kept taking time out to do other projects. So I performed all during college. I was a DJ for part of the time that I was in college. And when I finally left college, I went to Nashville and started working at Opryland Theme Park. Actually, it was called the Show Park back then. And I was in the Country Music USA show. Started singing country music then. And then eventually picked up the Wild West Arts, and that's been my career ever since. So there's a lot of holes in that story, but that's the basics.
I get it. Now, with the Wild West Arts, was there any person or somebody you used to watch that was an early influencer for you seeing those type of things?
Well, I mean, it goes way back as far as my love of Western entertainment goes. When I was a kid, I was born in 1955. So when I was a kid, most of the primetime lineup on TV was cowboy and Western series. Gunsmoke and Bonanza and the Wild Wild West and on and on and on, The Rifleman and all those old shows. So I was fascinated with it when I was a kid and really enjoyed it. Kind of put it behind me when I went to college. And I'll get into the Western arts here, but I need you to tell you a little background. So I was, when I went to college, I was into classic rock and jazz and blues. And in college, I studied classical vocal literature as well as opera. And I was kind of a snob about music. I didn't like country music back then. One year, something just fell in my apartment. I don't know what it was.
The ghost of Roy Rogers.
Yeah, exactly. One year I went to Nashville and was staying with some friends of mine, a band that had gone up there to work for some other singers. And they asked me if I wanted to go to a taping at the Grand Ole Opry. And at that taping was the original Bob Wills Texas Playboys were playing at that TV taping. And also Larry Gatlin and the Gatlin Brothers. And the Texas Playboys were Western Swing, which was really jazz. It was like a country Texas jazz, basically. And I really liked that because of my background in listening to jazz. And the Gatlin Brothers were three brothers that sang in harmony. And they sang more like formal singers do, and more like gospel harmony, things okay. like that. Relate to it, and I really liked what I heard. And when I went back to college, I got together with a couple of buddies of mine, and we learned a bunch of their music and started our own little band and started doing country music then. I went to Opryland. I was in the Country Music USA show for a couple of years, and we had a country band that we traveled around with. And I had a bad accident in 1986 where I broke my leg severely. And I was in the hospital for 6 months. For 3 months I was in the hospital in therapy for 6 months afterward. And when I got out of the hospital and out of therapy, I didn't want to perform anymore. I'd kind of lost all my self-confidence. And so I started doing sound mixing. I'd always been interested in sound since I was a singer. I wanted to know what was going on with the PA system. So I went to mixing sound instead of performing. And as luck would have it, living in Nashville, I worked for a sound company who set up sound for Larry Gatlin and the Gatlin Brothers. And the guy who was their mixer was buying a recording studio and was going to leave the band. And he asked me if I wanted the job. So I had gone from singing cover tunes of the Gatlin Brothers to mixing sound for the Gatlin Brothers.
Wow.
And I'm going to get to your question here in just a
second. No, you're good. Look, I'm enjoying all this.
But so I worked for Larry for a couple of years. And toward the end, the last 6 months I worked for him, he was actually cast to be the first Will Rogers, the third Will Rogers in the Will Rogers Follies on Broadway. Keith Carradine was the original. Mac Davis kind of held the place until we finished our tour, and then Larry took over. Larry Gatlin had to learn a few rope tricks for the Will Rogers Follies because Will Rogers, I don't know if everybody knows, but he was an incredible performer. He was a top trick roper. He went from the Wild West shows to vaudeville to the Ziegfeld Follies to starring in movies and writing syndicated column all over the country. Famous humorist, but he was an incredible trick roper. So Larry had to learn how to do the rope tricks for the role. Larry didn't ever like to do anything by himself. And none of the other band members or crew members were interested in what he was going to be doing, except me, because I had a theater background. The producers sent him a videotape of the show, which you can't get. I mean, so he wanted to know if I wanted to watch the show with him. And the roper who was on Broadway was a guy named Vince Bruce. Vince Bruce was probably the best trick roper Western artist of our generation. of my generation. And Vince sent him an instructional videotape and also a tape of his cabaret act. Now, I mentioned that I was an actor and a singer, and I was always frustrated with having to audition for other people's productions. I was also frustrated in waiting for producers to decide that they were going to cast people and put me in the show. And I was always jealous of magicians and jugglers and other variety acts that could just sell their act. And I had messed around with juggling a little bit. I wasn't really that efficient at it. I'd fooled around with magic some in the past, but I didn't really have a character and didn't feel like I wanted to do that. And Larry, we went to Knott's Berry Farm, and the trick roper who had taught Keith Carradine the tricks for the role was performing at Knott's Berry Farm in California. We did a couple of concerts there, and Larry arranged a trick roping lesson with him and asked me if I wanted to tag along with him. And I went to the roping lesson, and Gene McLaughlin was the roper. He said, well, if you're both going to be here, I might as well give you both a rope, and you might as well both take the class. So I got my first roping lesson with Larry. I was getting to the point where I was wanting to perform again. I'd gotten to where I was missing it. And being on the road with Larry for those last few months, I had lots of free time. And so I spent all my time practicing. When Larry went to Broadway, I went back to Opryland in Nashville, got a job as a, what they called streetmosphere performer, which we were just costume characters who would walk around and interact with the guests. Well, my character was called Grizzly Jack, and I looked enough, I was supposed to be a gold prospector, but it looked enough like a cowboy that I could get away with walking around the park practicing my trick roping. And also, Opryland, unlike other theme parks that have productions, had its own live entertainment staff. We had writers, directors, choreographer. We had the full gamut, and we had full rehearsal studios with mirrors, you know, dance studios. And so I would rehearse while I was walking around interacting with the guests all day. And then when I got off work, I would go straight to the rehearsal hall because they were generally open. So I would reserve it, and I would work in the rehearsal hall on my own material. And I developed my one-man show there. And the next year, they offered me a position doing my show in the park. And that's really where the show that I do now, it evolved from that. So that's a kind of a long roundabout story to tell you how I got into the Wild West arts. Like I said, I'd always been interested in it as a kid. I grew up in the country where neighbors had cattle, and I would go help them, you know, at branding time or rounding up the calves, things like that. But never really came from that kind of family. So it was very interesting to me. My voice fit the cowboy genre, and so it made sense to combine the trick roping, and I learned bullwhips shortly after that. And so if I combined all that stuff with my singing, I was able to come up with a variety act that I could sell that fit me better than magic or juggling or any of that stuff. So yeah, so that's where the current career came from.
Look, it's funny you mentioned the singing part. So the first video I watched of you, I didn't realize that as you're using the rope and you're involved with all the different rope stuff, you're singing right along with it.
Yeah.
And I was, to me, that's impressive. I always find things like that very interesting when people can do more than one task. They're not just beholden to the one portion. But I did have a question about the rope. And
okay. I did want to say before we go on,
yeah,
that is my signature. That's what got me well known in the Wild West arts community, was the fact that I really was the first person to do that. That song that you heard is from the Will Rogers Follies. And I choreographed all the rope tricks to kind of fit what the lyrics are saying. And as far as we know, no one else has done anything like that. My concept was to do sort of a song and dance number with the rope. So that really put me on the map and set me apart from all other Western acts, and kind of got me noticed. And that song has been in my show ever since those early days of that show that I did for Opryland. So that's my claim to fame right there, my signature.
I see. And that's, once I realized it, it makes sense because it sparked me right away. I was like, oh, wait, hold on. That's not like somebody in the background singing along to what he's doing. That's him. He's doing it as he's moving along here.
Well, my joke is, people ask me if it's hard to trick rope, and I say, no, it's hard to sing while you trick rope. But actually, it's very hard to trick rope. But yeah, that's my deal.
So the rope that's involved with doing what you do, is that is it very specific? Like, hey, you're not going to Home Depot or Lowe's and grabbing, you know, 10 feet of rope and doing that. Is it very specific to what you're doing, or is it really just any other kind of rope and anybody could do it?
Well, yes and no. It's a certain type of rope that I use, which is, let's talk about ropes real quick. So on the ranch, a cowboy would use a rope that's very, very stiff, and And you can do rope tricks with the rope like we use out on the ranch. I don't. The ropes we use out on the ranch, the thing about trick roping is when you're making a circle with the rope, the enemy of trick roping is kinks in the rope. Once the rope starts to twist up and the sliding knot that we call a honda in trick roping, if that gets all twisted up and gets locked up in the rope, well, then you're pretty much finished. You can't do any more rope tricks. And with a stiff rope like you use out on the ranch, which, by the way, is what the Mexican Chagros use, and they're the ones who really originated trick roping. United States, we borrowed it and adapted it to our style. Will Rogers actually used the same sort of rope that I use, which is a braided cotton rope, which is cut to the length of whatever kind of tricks I'm going to be doing. And it is more forgiving of kinks than the stiff rope like we would use out on the ranch. Okay. Or that the charros use. And it's not a lot easier, but it is a little more forgiving, and it's a different style. We generally call what I do rope spinning, if we were going to be totally technical. But yeah, that's the difference in the rope. Now, I do use a certain type of rope, and I get it from a place, and I'm going to plug my guys because
please.
My instructional DVD is sold by Western Stage Props, who sell everything you need for Wild West Arts. They're located in Las Vegas, and it's westernstageprops.com. And they sell the rope that we use. They also sell the stiffer rope if you want to use that kind to rope with. They sell bull whips. They sell replica guns and holsters and trick riding saddles and throwing knives. All those things are considered in the Wild West Arts. Anything you would see at a rodeo pretty much is considered in the Wild West Arts. So they do sell the kind of rope I use. But that being said, I was at a convention with some kids from Germany quite a few years back, and back in 1995 or 96 or so, the shipping wasn't like it is now, and they were unable to get the kind of rope we use in the States, and they had some rope that if I were to look at it, I would say, no, you shouldn't use that to rope with, but they were doing great with it because they didn't know that they weren't supposed to be able to rope with that. So to some extent, yes, you need to have a certain type of rope, but to another, desire and persistence is probably even more important. So I'll qualify that answer, but yes, if you want to get started in it, definitely, get in touch with Western Stage Props and get a rope that they would recommend, because it'll be a lot easier on you.
Now, you also do the bullwhip, which I think that's just the coolest thing. But I know now, in my mind, when I first think about a whip, it's that super long kind of a whip. What's the difference between one of those and what you're using on the stage?
Well, it's basically just the length as far as a bullwhip. Now, a bullwhip is a whip that has the handle either braided into the thong, what we call the thong, which is the basic body of the whip. And so the bullwhip either has the handle braided into it or in line with it. It could be a wooden handle that just has the whip on the end of it. But that is different from what we call a stock whip, which has a longer handle, and the thong is kind of attached with leather so that it kind of swivels. It's not a swivel whip. I wouldn't recommend those to anybody. But it.
What's a swivel whip?
A swivel whip is a whip that has a built-in swivel on the top of it. It's a bull whip that has a swivel. And really, it's only useful if you're going to be swinging it around your head and doing one particular type of crack. If you're doing work and things like that, you really don't want that swivel, because that makes the whip a lot less accurate. But now on the stock whip, it just naturally made that way. There's also cow whips, there's carriage whips, there's snake whips, and a snake whip basically doesn't have a handle at all. It's got usually has a lot more weight in the butt of the whip down where the handle would be to help propel the whip. But there's several different types. I prefer the bull whip because it's a classic cowboy style whip. That's what I learned on. That's what I like. It's not as hard on your wrist as a stock whip is. So I prefer a bull whip in that. Now, I use whips that are about, well, we measure them differently. And it's kind of hard to describe in just a voice call. But my whips are total length from butt to the end of the cracker, about 5.5 or 6 feet total length. I get so much people coming up to me after the show and saying, oh, my uncle had a 20-foot whip. Like, yeah, no, he didn't. But everybody seems to overestimate what the length of a whip is, because a 20-foot whip is really, that's a very specialty whip. There's not too many people who would use that. I use a shorter whip because most stages that I appear on don't have the headroom to be able to use much longer whip than 6 feet. You may get away with 8 feet. 10 feet would be pretty much too long on just about any stage, unless you're in a circus tent where you got a lot of headroom to be able to use it. So the length is, it's people have never come up to me after my show and said, wow, those whips are really short. they don't know. They don't think about it when you're on stage. But yeah, I use shorter whips just because of the stages that I perform in.
Yeah, I don't know how I'd feel if somebody came up to me and said, man, your whip's really small.
Exactly. that's not very polite. No, that's totally the reason why I use shorter whips. And I use about an 8-foot whip to start out with, because I crack it really loud the first time I crack it. And then I don't have to crack the whips that loud after that. Once you set that in people's mind, then I don't have to worry about making them too awful loud once I've done that once. And it gets the point across. So, yeah, that's all I use. I don't use anything longer than that. I have a 10-foot whip that I may be using in the show that's coming up that I'm going to be doing, but only just to demonstrate the difference in the length and talk about what we just talked about.
Now, how difficult, between the two of them, between the rope and the whip, what was the difficulty in learning those type of things? I know it sounded like with the rope, you had an instructor, this is what this guy did. He was, the best of the best. He showed you what to do. But with the bullwhip, was that more of like, well, I'm going out in the parking lot and keep your cars and your kids away?
No, somebody showed me what to do on that. We have these conventions, Wild West Arts conventions, and I was trick roping. And one of the conventions I went to, there was a lady doing whips there, and she just said, "Hey, you want to learn how to crack the whip?" I said, "Sure." First time it made a noise, I was hooked. I was like, okay, I've got to get some whips and do this. It's like that for a lot of people. And the whips are, I mean, you do need to learn the correct techniques because you can hurt yourself with whips. And so the correct techniques are essential because the thing that everybody thinks is the way to crack a whip is totally not the way to crack a whip. And it can bite you because it brings the whip right back towards you where it's very difficult to control. Most of the cracks that most whip crackers do are away from the body out at the end of the whip. You don't pull it back towards you like you do when you're popping someone with a towel or something, which is the way most people think you use a whip, which is totally not. So, yes, you need someone to teach you the correct techniques, but there are a whole lot more whip crackers than there are trick ropers. And that's because trick roping, I can teach you the basics of whip cracking in a couple of weeks. Trick roping, we're going to need a couple of years, to come down on all the basics. Or if you're really practicing hard like I was when I started and had a lot of spare time to do it, then maybe you could get a lot accomplished in a year. But it's one of the hardest physical manipulation skills that I've ever attempted. And I've tried a whole bunch of them. I've had world-class jugglers say, well, everything takes practice. Yeah, but here, you try this. They go, oh, okay. Okay, I see what you mean now. Okay. So, yeah, it's a frustrating art form because you reach these plateaus and you think, oh, I've got this trick down now, and then you can't do it again for another month. So it's a lot of just repetition.
The muscle memory must be pretty extreme with those.
Yeah, because there's a lot of subtlety in the rope. You're not just throwing it up and catching it. You're not just doing one crack. You're actually manipulating in several different planes. And it just takes a lot of repetition. That's all I can say. And a lot of not getting frustrated with the fact that, I could do it yesterday. Why can't I do it again today? It's not like, well, I've got it now. I've got it. It's a constant process until you reach a certain point.
Now, do you do anything? I know with being on the stage, do you do any, or have you done in the past, any like trick shooting or the knife throwing?
Well, I do knife throwing, or I did do knife and tomahawk throwing just as a hobby. I never really wanted to do an act with it because, number one, I don't travel with a partner, and knife throwing is sort of one of those things where you need someone to stand at the board because you need that element of danger and that element of trust between the person standing at the board and the person throwing the knives. You need the audience to care about the person who is vulnerable at the board for it to actually grab you. I don't think there's that much call for just throwing knives at targets. And I never wanted to carry all the equipment. I mean, all the knives you have to carry and the board and all the related stuff, just a bunch of stuff to haul. Early in my career, one of the old rodeo guys, we were doing a rodeo together, and I was apologizing basically to him because I didn't have a horse, because I always like it when the trick roper has a horse at a rodeo and they rope on the back of the horse. And he said, "Son, my advice to you is just keep it a suitcase out. You're doing much better with just a suitcase. More expensive and hauling them and taking care of them." And he said, "No, stick to a suitcase act." So knife throwing was a little too much to carry for me. I did do gun spinning and quick draw for a little while. It's gotten so difficult to travel with even replicas. And besides that, you have to really have a real gun to do any real like trick shooting or anything. And I used to do quick draw at the rodeos where I would quick draw on a balloon in the arena, with what we call a balloon blank, which is a blank that has some ground up corn cobs on the top of the gunpowder, and they basically travel about 15 feet before they burn out. So you've got these little burning sparks. It's kind of like having a little shotgun that you're shooting the balloon with.
You still like snake shot or something like that.
Yeah, you still have to hit it, and it's still a very small pattern, but it is a little bigger pattern than a bullet would give you. And if you're in an arena and you've got it burns out by 15 feet, then as long as nobody's standing right behind the balloon, you pretty much can do it safely. But traveling across state lines with a real gun that's set up for quick draw, well, now you run into problems. And pretty much several years ago, a lot of the gun guys had to get federal firearms licenses to be able to travel state to state with a firearm. And I didn't want to go to that much trouble. And you got to have an actual location of a gun shop or a gunsmith shop to do that. And besides that, I've got arthritis in my fingers, and gun spinning, if you've got arthritis in your knuckles, is not fun at all. So since it was so much of a hassle and so painful to do, I gave that up quite a few years ago. I could still do some gun spinning if somebody wanted me to do it for a movie and they took care of all the logistics and everything, but it's not part of my regular show anymore.
The juice isn't worth the squeeze.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was asked to go to Atlantis in the Bahamas to do a July the 4th thing, and they specifically requested that I bring the gun for some gun spinning. And I was bringing a replica, and I was flying out of Brooklyn from JFK, and it took me 2 hours at the airport to get a non-firing replica. It didn't even have a hole in the barrel. You couldn't put a bullet in that gun. If you somehow managed to put a bullet in it, it would blow up in your hand. and every TSA security guard, policeman had to come look at it to get it on the flight. And coming back from the Bahamas was even harder to come back with it. And that was really seal the deal. That was when I said, nah, this is just too much hassle. And I'm not a crusader, you know. I don't get political. I want people to come to my show and have a good time. I'm not trying to advocate for or against guns. I don't want to fight that fight. A lot of times I go to schools, places like that, which wouldn't allow it anyway. They barely allow the whips.
Oh, really?
Well, and I fought that, and I'm going to get in trouble for this, but I fought that because I blame the macho guys who insist that a bullwhip is a good weapon. And there are some very famous people who advocate it, who are very famous bullwhip trainers, and there's a combat whip group on Facebook. But, you know, to me, the whip is not a good weapon if you're using it as a whip, because all someone has to do is close the distance and get close up to you, and then you can't use it as a whip anymore. You could maybe hit them with the handle or try to choke them with the body of the whip like it was a rope. But as far as a whip, actually cracking it and using it as a weapon against someone, I don't believe it's a great weapon. And because people have tried to make it such a weapon, well, then it gets banned. Like, in, I can't fly with my whips in the carry-on, which, if you tried to use it, it'd be just ridiculous. It's like, really? Yeah, I can't. But because some people call it a weapon, then you can't take it on the plane.
I think you're Harrison Ford, Indiana Jones in it.
Yeah, and it's the same thing at some schools in places that are very tight on the weapon restriction who think it's a weapon. There have been recreational whip cracking groups, which those exist, but there have been some colleges that have been banned from doing it on the colleges. Some public parks in the New York area, you, you can get, you know, if not in trouble, you can get people being very annoyed with you, to use them there. There's a little bit of a stigma on the bullwhip as far as, you know, being used as a torture device, being used in connection with slavery, things like that.
Right,
so,
yeah.
So you know, you got to be careful of some of those things. And I just don't think that the guys who insist that it's a wonderful weapon are helping us out any. I mean, if it was a wonderful weapon, then there would be videos on YouTube of guys, you know, in a street fight using a bullwhip to save himself. and there are none, by the way. If you look, if you try to find whip fights, you will find guys who use whips who agree to, like, have these matches where they just whip each other with the whips, you know. But to me, that's not a real defensive weapon. My question to the guys who use the whips is, well, if you say it's a weapon, then I'm sure when you go to the bad part of town, you're carrying your whip with you, right? And I've never found one of them who does. So if it's such a great weapon, then why aren't you carrying it all the time? So that's my big thing. And I wish I had the money, because I wanted to do a challenge where I would get an MMA fighter and put him up against whoever the badass whip guy was. And we'll see how long it takes for the whip guy to be in a chokehold or have to tap out because he's going to get his arm broken, you know. But now, see, I've said too much. Now I'm going to get all this stuff from all the whip weapon.
Oh, guys. I love it. I love it, because I'm sitting here as you're saying this, and I'm like, any one of these would be phenomenal names for this episode. We can go with "Don't bring a gun to a whip fight." Or whip fighter versus MMA, yeah. Any one of these would be phenomenal titles. Like, I just see somebody, like, walking down the street and somebody being like, "Give me your money," and this guy being like, "Hold on, I'm gonna unfurl my whip."
Yeah,
I gotta get 6 feet away from you though for this to be really effective.
Exactly. You
know? There's a reason that Harrison Ford in Indiana Jones didn't pull the whip out and use it, and just pulled the gun and was like, "I'm done."
Well, the famous scene is where, you know, he's cracking the whip a bunch of times, and the guy pulls out a sword and he throws the whip down, pulls his gun out, and shoots him. That's
it.
You do, you know, it's this. But anyway, yeah, I've had guys say, "Oh, well, I would hit the guy in the eye." Well, okay, good luck. And he was a real badass. He would take him, and he would, you know, choke you out or break your arm or your leg, and then he'd worry about his eye.
Oh, that's so great. Please record that next conversation that you have with somebody. Be like, I just got to record this. Murph needs to hear this.
Well, if somebody wasn't that good a fighter and didn't know about whips, okay, maybe you could make the case that you cracked the whips a few times and scared him off and he ran away. Okay, but as far as being a real defensive weapon, I don't buy it. And until I see it happen, I won't buy it.
Yeah, I'm going to go with you there on that one, that the whip is not top of my list. Unless I'm playing Dungeons and Dragons or some fantasy role-playing game, then sure, we're good. You know, your magic whip is perfectly acceptable, but I don't think it's you're not going out and field carrying a 6 foot whip under your jacket.
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, I have a little snake whip that's about 3.5 feet long, 4 feet long, and you know, sometimes I carry it around if I'm going to go someplace and I'm going to stroll around and I need to do a couple of things for people if I'm walking around at a party or something like that. But no, I would never, ever pull the whip out because somebody's going to shoot you. Don't do that.
It's a bad plan all the way around.
Yeah, if you need to defend yourself, get a gun, get a carry license, you know, get your concealed carry or whatever if you really need it to defend yourself. Get a gun. Don't fool around with a whip.
That's so great. Oh gosh, that's so great. Now you mentioned some of the places that you've been. I know we have our mutual friend in Throw, and I know you work the shows down in New York City with him, and you're out in Branson right now. Where has this stuff taken you? I know you were, so you already said you were what engineer or would it be sound man when you were with the Gatlin brothers? What would be the right?
Yeah, I did sound. Oh, well, nowadays people make a differentiation between the sound mixer and a sound engineer. Although I don't know, we used to be called sound engineers, but I can't go into the board and fix it. I'm not good on engineering.
Right.
But I am a mixer. I was a what they call a front of house mixer, which is the guy who mixes the sound that the audience hears. And generally, the bigger bands have a monitor mixer who's mixing what the band hears on stage. So, yeah, so I did that for a while, and I traveled all around the United States and went to England with one of the acts that I was with, and Canada with sound mixing. With Western Arts, I've been to Russia, England, Bali, been to Mexico. I did quite a few. For the last 10 years, I've been doing shows at a resort chain in Mexico between Cancun and Tulum resorts owned by the AM Resort Company. And I was doing a one-man show there for about 10 years, mostly down there. And the producers that produced that particular gig live in Branson. And they basically told, well, we were sent home from Mexico March the 18th because of COVID. And I stayed with my brother and sister-in-law down in Louisiana until basically the end of August, and then moved here to Branson because they found a theater going to make them a good deal on producing shows there. So they wanted to do a variety show, which we were doing. But we had to stop that. We weren't getting very good crowds with that particular show. They stopped that. They sent two of the performers home, and they offered two of us our own one-man shows because it's a lot cheaper for them to, you know, deal with one person instead of four, pay salaries and apartment housing and all that stuff. So, yeah, Branson's one of the only places in town, and our crowds are not that big. You have to wear a mask into the lobby. Once you get in your seats, you can take your mask off. The theater is not full enough that we're crowded at all, so there's plenty of room to socially distance. And the audience members are asked to just do that voluntarily. The seats aren't blocked off or anything. So it's a little bit looser here than it is in other places as far as that goes. And the COVID rate is not that bad in this county. And we're being as careful as we can. But I don't know. For me, just the ability to get back on stage, because it's my addiction. I can't live without performing. That's why I went back to it after I did sound for all those years. Because toward the end of my time with Larry Gatlin, I was really feeling like I was going to die if I didn't get back on stage. So I had regained my confidence and really wanted to do it again. I'm addicted to it. It was my acceptance in school, in church. This is how I was accepted by people, was by getting up on stage and performing for them. I was a bit of a loner and a wallflower off stage, but when I turn it on and become a character and start performing, even if I'm at a bar or club or something, well, then I'm better able to relate to people. So the buzz I get from an audience is like no other, and I'm totally addicted.
You know, you're the, since I started doing the podcast, you're the fourth entertainer that I've interviewed. And probably one of my favorite things to do is talking to the people in the entertainment industry. And I asked a couple of people the same question of if you weren't doing this, what would you be doing? That very kind of typical question. And I have to tell you, especially with your answer, and I realized it last week when I talked to Adam Cardone, and I got the feel when I talked to Throw and RJ Lewis, I don't think once you've reached a certain point that, like gentlemen like yourselves, you couldn't do anything else. If you're not entertaining, if you're not on a stage, you're not involved in that way. I don't know. I mean, because you can hear the passion in your voice. Like, this is your thing. You need to be there.
Yeah, it is. I don't know what else I'd do. I would do voiceovers, or I would do DJ work or something like that that's related to it. Well, and like in my life, I mean, I really have rarely worked jobs that weren't connected with the industry. You know, a lot of actors wait tables when they're not doing shows, but my plan was not to wait tables. It was to do sound on the side so I could at least be connected to it. So it would be something adjacent to performance if I couldn't perform anymore. But I'm pretty sure I'll be doing this up until I'm dead or have some sort of disease that I can't do it anymore. Because there's nothing else like it.
This is your passion.
We had a question and answer thing with one of the musicals I was in. I've toured with a couple of different musicals, and I've done over 13 productions of the Will Rogers Follies now. We had some young performers say, well, you know, how can I do this? And my best answer for them was, if you have to, you will. I mean, you'll find a way, because I have to. And I think that's the thing. I think most professional entertainers are similar in this way, that they just have to. The odds are against you in this business anyway. And most people, you know, if you don't have to do it, if you're not addicted to it like I am, and Cardone and all of us really, then I don't think you would stick with it. I'm not sure about that. I do know a few people who perform, and it's just their job, and they're not quite as crazy with it as I am. But most people do. And I think that's great that you're talking to performers like this, because I was going to try to do a documentary one time about, you know, what makes us perform. I kind of know that it was about acceptance for me, because I was a preacher's kid and we moved a lot. My father went to different churches. And so I was the new kid in school several times during my school career. And when you're a preacher's kid, either you're the rebellious kid who does everything bad, or you're trying to be the good kid. I always tried to be the good kid, but when you're the good kid, you're like the goody two-shoes. And, you know, the kids don't want to tell a dirty joke around you, or don't want to take you out when they go out to drink or something like that. So it kind of makes you an outsider. And performing was the way that I could be accepted by them. Also, I grew up in the classic rock era, and I wanted to be a hippie, and I grew my hair as long as I could. Our school had dress restrictions, but I grew it as long as I could, and some of the people in my father's church didn't like it, but when I sang, they liked me. The old lady even told me that. Oh, honey, I love when you sing. I just can't stand to look at you. So I know the psychological reasons why this. Yeah, it's kind of pathetic. It's kind of that, oh, love me, love me, love me. Comedians have the same thing, you know. You know, getting beat up, or being the class clown was the way you got accepted. The same sort of thing.
Well, I you brought this up, so I have to bring it up. So sure. you have very good hair, and you have a very impressive goatee and mustache. I will tell everyone to go look up Chris. And you gotta, you know, nowadays we have all got, you know, I just today shaved for the first time in a while. My beard, I retired out of the Marine Corps back in 2014, and I swore I'd never shave again. And then I realized with wanting to work, and I'm not very entertaining, I was going to have to shave. they don't get my humor in most places. So I was like, nope, I'm going to have to shave. Do you have, and this is so sidebar to all this, but I know I sat there and this is so me. I was like, he's got a really killer mustache goatee thing going on here. Do you like when you fix it up, like in the pictures, are you doing that yourself or you got somebody coming in and helping you out?
No, it's all natural. It just ends up that way. It's pretty much always been natural. I've never had really a stylist do anything with it. I'm blessed. My family, we don't have any real baldness that runs through my family, so I don't have that to worry about. And like I said, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a hippie, and always got in trouble for it back then. But since I got older, I was actually my
hair still there, Chris. There you are.
Well, my hair was a little shorter, and my beard was a full beard back when I was doing the Grizzly Jack thing at Opryland. And when I stopped doing that gig, I was doing the first Will Rogers Follies that I ever did at a dinner theater in Nashville. And a rodeo producer, his wife loved musicals, and so she dragged him to this musical. He saw me trick rope and do the gun spinning and the whips. And he said, hey, we're going to do a tribute to Buffalo Bill at our rodeos for the next few years. You want to come perform at our rodeos? And I, of course, I did, because that gave me some street cred as a cowboy to be able to work in rodeos. And his idea was that I would glue the beard on, wear a wig. Well, he did outdoor rodeos, which are dirty and muddy and dusty. And I said, no, that's going to be awful to do that all the time, so I'll just grow it. And I grew my hair out for the role of Buffalo Bill, and it just stuck. It became like a brand. You can sort of look at me, especially if I'm wearing the hat, and you can almost know what I do. I mean, it's pretty easy to tell when you see me. So it just stuck. I didn't want to redo all of my publicity material and photos and all that stuff, and just kept the look. And that's where we are today.
It's a very Wild Bill Hickok.
Well, now I mentioned Buffalo Bill. Actually, a lot of people say Wild Bill, and I know the confusion is because they both have Bill in the word.
Right. And
Wild Bill Hickok did perform in some Wild West shows, but not for long, because he really didn't take to it. The reports are that when he was
too drunk.
Well, he did, and he also would instead of using blanks, he'd actually load up his guns with real bullets. I didn't know that. but yeah, and the rumor has it that he punched a taxi driver the first time he was in New York to do a show because he thought that the guy was overcharging him, so he attacked him, and there was all sort of problems with him as far as the Wild West shows. And of course, as we know, he got shot in the back of the head in Deadwood, South Dakota, holding the Aces and Eights. And Buffalo Bill lived to an old age and died of, old age, basically, or sickness. And Buffalo Bill was the guy who really embraced the performing and started the Wild West show. And right. Well, okay. Ned Buntline wrote a series of dime novels, which are very popular in New York and the Northeast. And he started the shows on Broadway and in New York City that were about Buffalo Bill. They were fictionalized, but they were about Buffalo Bill. Buffalo Bill came to see one of the shows and eventually was talked into being in the shows on stage in New York, and then did his first outdoor show, I think, in 1883, I believe, was when the first Old Glory blowout was. And so if it weren't for Buffalo Bill, we wouldn't have this idea of the cowboy as an American hero. I mean, the cowboy back in the days before the Wild West shows was akin to being a shepherd or a pig, someone who took care of pigs. I mean, it was not a glamorous life. It wasn't romanticized like it is now, like Buffalo Bill did with it. And so we probably wouldn't have Western movies and cowboy shows and rodeos and all that stuff if it wouldn't have been for Buffalo Bill and the Wild West Show. So that's the difference in Wild Bill Hickok and Buffalo Bill Cody. But Buffalo Bill Cody is technically the guy I look more like because Wild Bill Hickok didn't have the beard portion. From time to time, he had a little what we call now a soul patch, but mostly he had the big mustache.
Okay.
I don't think he lived long enough to have white hair. Buffalo Bill did. So the difference is people get that confused all the time. And, of course, I get called Colonel Sanders and Kenny Rogers and Willie Nelson, which makes no sense. But
yeah, I wouldn't go with the Willie Nelson.
And Santa Claus, which I don't like. I don't like that. I work hard on my figure. I don't want to be called Santa Claus.
Oh, that's so amazing. So now, Chris, you've been in Branson. First show in Branson?
Well, actually, I performed here in 2012 at a place called Silver Dollar City, which is a theme park that is themed like you were in the 1880s or 1900s. It looks like an old Ozark town. All the people are dressed in period costumes. And every fall, they do a fall festival. Back in 2012, they were doing a salute to the American cowboy. They had me performing. They had cowboy poets. They had cowboy artists, as far as visual artists. They had cowboy bands performing. And so I was there for 6 weeks in 2012. And I haven't performed in Branson other than that until now. And when I came here, we were doing a show called Masters of the Unusual, which featured me, a guy named Daniel Jenkins, who does an Elvis impersonation, a mentalist that a lot of your listeners may know, named Banachek, who was one of the consultants on Chris Angel's Mind Freak show. He's incredible. He's invented a lot of things in mentalism. He and his girlfriend, who's named Anna Dangerous, who is a crossbow artist, a Russian crossbow artist. So we were all in a variety show together. And as I said, they had to close the variety show. Sent Banachek and Anna sent them back home, basically, and then offered us, the two of us left, the Elvis guy, his own show, and me, my own show. The producer of the show thinks that my show will be perfect for here. All my career, people have been telling me, oh, you should do your show in Branson. But I got to tell you, it was always well received in New York and in the Northwest, the Northeast. Because, and if you think about it, Buffalo Bill and Will Rogers both received most of their fame from performing in New York. Because it's different there. It's a novelty.
Yes.
If I'm out west or I'm even in Branson, there are other people who do what I do, or maybe rodeo artists or maybe farmers or ranchers who are familiar with it. So it's not that different to them. Whereas in New York City, there's two of us, basically.
Right.
Yeah. So I've got great audiences and great response in New York City. It's getting so much more expensive to live there. And right now there's no theater shows going on anyway. So I came to Branson and we'll see how it goes. They think it's perfect because there's nobody else really doing it here. As far as what I'm doing, there is another guy who does trick roping, bull whips, gun spinning, but he doesn't do cowboy music. He doesn't do a full hour and a half show. I guess I am unique here now.
Well, that's awesome. So if somebody wanted to find your video, your instructional video, that's under the westernstageprops.com. Where else can they find you at?
It is, and it's also, I have some instructional tip videos and things on my YouTube channel, which I think it's Chris B. Bill, as in Chris Buffalo Bill. So if you just abbreviate the Buffalo, so it's Chris B. Bill. I believe is the YouTube channel. I don't do much on it. There are some instructional videos on there. They could also get in touch with me.
Sounds like a great rap name.
So, what's that?
So that sounds like an even better rapper name. Crispy Bill? Like a Crispy Bill? Crispy Bill. I mean, that's, if this doesn't work out for you after all these years, that's you could have a career as a rapper.
Yeah. No, actually, that's one of my email addresses is that. But yeah, they can get in touch with me over Facebook, or I'm on Facebook at Chris McDaniel. I've also got a performer page, which is I need to work on. But yeah, you can get the DVD from westernstageprops.com. You can get a roping set, which will include a beginning rope and the DVD together, if you want to get that. And I'm all about passing on the knowledge that I have. So I'm totally willing to work with anybody, especially in trick roping. If they're dedicated enough to put in the time and the work to do it, then I'm there to help them. And I basically charge whatever they can afford. I know how it is to be a performer. And I know how it is right now in the COVID time. So I'm very generous with that. Because I don't want anybody who wants to learn and wants to perform with it, who is a performer also, I don't want them not to be able to learn because of cost. So I'm very much into passing it on. I had some teachers who were very generous with me and who just asked me to pass it on down the line and make sure that, especially trick roping, because it's not an art form that can die. And there are fewer and fewer people who pick it up. A lot of people don't have the time to invest. That's understandable. They learn one or two tricks. The people who stick with it and really learn the full repertoire, are going out performing with it, are pretty rare still. So I'm pretty confident about doing that for people. That it's just, you know, I feel this obligation.
I like it. So is there any other place that if somebody wanted to find you anything, you know, we got the Facebook, we got the Western Stage Props, all those locations, you have your performer pages. They can come out and see you in Branson. They can find you out there. And the name of that show again was?
In Branson, the name of my show, the name of my show is Ropes, Whips, and Cowboy Songs. And my show is.
Glad you put Cowboy Songs at the end of that.
Yeah. And my show is Ropes, Whips, and Cowboy Songs. Someone asked me, they said, well, what kind of name is that? And I thought, well, you know, we worked on trying to come up with some sort of name, and we thought, well, just a basic description of what's in the show is a good enough name. Actually, I did the precursor to this particular show was done at a place called the Canal Park Playhouse, which is no longer because it was a basement theater that got flooded during Rita. What was the one that came through? It flooded Coney Island and flooded Long Island.
Katrina? No.
No, the now I can't. Sandy?
Was Sandy. Sandy.
Yeah, I think that was the one. Anyway, his theater got flooded, so I didn't go back and do it again. But the show then was called Ropes, Whips, and Songs About Cows, which is not really true. The first iteration of that was supposed to be Ropes, Whips, and Songs for Cows, because cowboy songs basically evolved out of and if you come see my show you'll hear this in my show, but basically evolved because on the cattle drives, when they were driving the cattle from South Texas up to Chicago to put them on the rail, you know, the train lines, put them on the rail cars and ship them to all over the country. At night, the worst thing that could happen to the cowboys on the cattle drive was a stampede, because you could be killed extremely easily in the stampede. And when you've got a herd of cattle out on the open plain with no way to fence them in, they're all just out there in the open. You got a few cowboys that ride watch at night, and anything, a coyote, a wolf attack, lightning, anything could set off a stampede, and that could be deadly for the cowboys. So the cowboys would ride around the cattle, and they would sing to the cattle to keep them calm. And that really evolved into cowboy music, cowboy songs with lyrics, things like that. So that was the original idea, was ropes, whips, and songs for cows. One of my friends, Todd Robbins, who's a wonderful performer in New York City, he suggested songs about cows. Sounded better, and that's where we got the name. Here, we wanted to make it even a little more clear what we were doing, so we called it Ropes, Whips, and Cowboys. So that show is now playing at the Branson Star Theater, and you can check that out on BransonStarTheater.com. And it starts this Tuesday. We're doing afternoon shows on Tuesdays at 2 o'clock, morning shows on Thursdays and Saturdays at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I know that sounds like a really early time for a show, but apparently, well, Branson is, there are a lot of older folks who come to vacation here. And a lot of the older folks enjoy seeing shows at 10 o'clock in the morning. So that's one of the reasons why we're performing this time.
Yeah. I have to tell you, Chris, this was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. I've learned a lot about the cowboy arts. I'll give you one quick story. Like, I grew up with a dad who loved Westerns. I enjoy Westerns. There probably isn't too many that, especially the more modern ones that come on, that I'm not willing to sit down and watch. Open Range. Gosh, I just forgot the name of it with Robert Duvall, and I can't think of the name of it now. I'm having a brain fart. It happens. But my middle son, his name is Dylan Matthew. The first words out of my father's mouth was, "Did you mean to name him after Gunsmoke, Matt Dylan?" I was like, no, Dad. That never crossed my mind. But folks, again, Chris, thank you so much. If you want to reach out to us, get any more information on Chris, it'll be in the underneath the show description. Our Twitter is @AboveTheBar4. Our way too long Instagram is @Above_The_Bar_Podcast. Make sure you hit that subscribe, like button on all your major platforms. You can find us on Facebook at The Above the Bar Podcast, and our email is theabovethebarpodcast@gmail.com. Any last words of wisdom for us there, Chris?
Oh, never squat with your spurs on. That's an old one.
Yeah, that'd be a real pain in the ass.
Yep. Always drink upstream from the herd.
Again, all wise words. All right, folks. Go ahead.
It'll take you a second to figure the always drink upstream from the herd. But
it's like avoiding the yellow snow.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, folks. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Be sure to push your stool in.